Greetings, everyone. Welcome to the ABF Fellows CLE. Our program for this afternoon is entitled the Age-Old Question Facing All of Us, Deny People Any Help or Allow Some Help from Non-Lawyers, and subtitled An Innovation's Odyssey. Our panel today is going to be moderated by Don Bivens. Don will introduce the distinguished panelists, but first, I want to take just a moment to introduce Don himself. So Don is the principal attorney at Don Bivens PLLC in Scottsdale, Arizona, nearby. His firm specializes in litigation, mediation, and arbitration, as well as in advising law firms on Arizona's Alternative Business Structures Program, which allows non-lawyers to hold a financial interest or a governance interest in law firms. Don has also been a fellow of the American Bar Foundation since 1994. I remember 1994, but I realize fewer and fewer people do. In any case, and I realize one of these days I won't be able to remember it either, even though I was there. Any case, Don has been a fellow since 1994, and he's currently a patron fellow. He has over 80 years of big law trial and appellate experience in complex litigation, class actions, as well as in arbitration and mediation. And he's been recognized across multiple practice areas as a best lawyer, a super lawyer, and three times as lawyer of the year. So if we count back to 1994, that would be about once a decade at least. And in any case, he is also a member of the American Law Institute. He chairs the ABA Center for Innovation, and he has served as chair of the ABA's litigation section, president of the State Bar of Arizona, and chair of the board of non-legal service providers. In all these roles, Don has been not only a fearless champion for his own clients, but also a relentless advocate, as the ABF model would put it, for expanding knowledge and advancing justice for all in need. And we're grateful to Don's friendship to the ABF over the years, and we're particularly thrilled to have him here to join us and to moderate our panel today. And with that, I give you Don Bivens.
Thank you. At 80 years, this is my second life. Welcome to Arizona. Welcome to our hometown. We hope you enjoy it. Rudy and I are the token Arizonans up here on this panel. We will tell you a little more, give you info and restaurant recommendations if you want in the aisles. I'm here chiefly, I think, because of my role as I do chair the committee here, the Supreme Court committee here, on non-lawyer service providers, which we call legal paraprofessionals. We also have certified document preparers in Arizona and have for about 25 years. So we have a fairly broad range of non-lawyer legal service providers. And maybe I can pepper these guys with questions about that as we go. But here's our panel. Steve is a professor emeritus with the American Bar Foundation. Too many publications on innovation to mention, but he's going to be talking about his work and research on non-lawyer legal service providers. Michelle, strangely enough, is affiliated with the medical school at the University of Minnesota. She'll explain. But she's done a lot of work on community service, community justice workers, and rural and small town needs for legal service providers. And Rudy, on the end, is 35 years with the DNA People's Clinic on the Navajo Nation. He's admitted both in Texas and the Hopi Nation and on the Navajo Nation and in our federal courts, and has the privilege of living in Gallup, New Mexico, but going to work in one of the most beautiful places in Arizona, Window Rock. So if you've ever seen that picture with the big hole that goes over like this, that's Window Rock, and that's where the Navajo Nation is. So we're going to let them speak in a row. We'll have about 30 minutes, I think, at the end for questions. So I might ask, unless it's just intuitively obvious, to hold the questions till the end, and that way we'll have everybody's a chance to show us their stuff, and then we'll have enter into a discussion. Steve, have you go first?
Thank you, Don, and thank you all for coming. And I'm going to talk a bit about my research. I got the first slide up there. All right, so I've characterized things as an odyssey. And an odyssey, in the classical sense, is a journey full of adventures. Adventures always have some danger and some risk. But it's a series of experiences giving knowledge or understanding. And so what I want to start talking about here is what we've learned from a story that begins in 2012 when Washington State authorized a non-lawyer program, what they called LLT, Limited License Legal Technicians. And basically that is the rough model, formally trained, minimum a two-year program, certain particular course requirements, plus substantial clinical requirements. Originally in Washington State, to become a technician, you needed 3,000 hours of hands-on experience. It's been lowered to 15, but that's a hell of a lot more than almost any law student gets, which I always found curious. But this is someone licensed and regulated, authorized to provide a narrowly prescribed set of legal services without the supervision of a licensed attorney, and this is one of the key points, independently, but in a well-defined practice area. At the outset in Washington, it's family law. Now, so I do research on these kinds of programs. I want to talk a bit today about what we can say we've learned from this odyssey. And to start, I have a way of kind of trying to frame it, and it's from a commentary in 2015, right before the first legal technician was licensed in Washington State. And as the author of the commentary put it, are we looking at a harbinger of the future or a one-state folly? In other words, I'm wrong to say it's an odyssey, and really it's just a short story with not a happy ending, maybe. Okay, I have to maneuver this sucker. All right, so the Washington State program. The idea was not new. Washington just didn't create this out of thin air with no context or anything, although it took almost 10 years for them to get it authorized. But many states and activists have been looking at this idea of a non-lawyer provider. In the mid-90s, the ABA even had a task force that looked at this, held hearings around the country to look into the feasibility and the possibility of this. It went nowhere. And in fact, I've discovered it's very difficult even to find the reports that were made by this task force in the middle 90s. Needless to say, there's a lot of opposition within the bar to non-lawyers offering any legal services, especially without the supervision of an attorney. But Washington State did it. They did the impossible, despite fierce opposition from the organized bar in Washington State. And its proponents, after it was authorized, spoke, traveled, and wrote widely on this new innovation. They enthusiastically were kind of promoting it as something that was needed, and its time had come. And a lot of places, a lot of states and activists were watching it. But, big but here, it was ended in June of 2020 by the Washington State Supreme Court. They sunsetted it. Now, that's their term, not mine, and what that meant is that they were stopping the program. It could not expand any farther than family law, where it started, with a very narrow set of things that technicians could do. It said there'll be no more new technicians, except for those in the pipeline. They could finish. And so the program still operates, but with no new technicians after those in the pipeline. There are now about 73 who are still active. So for all the hoopla and all the enthusiasm about this Washington program of letting the genie out of the bottle, nobody could do this before Washington did. It closes down. There are lots of reasons why. Part of it is selling it for things that it probably couldn't do. It was never really going to be a program that was going to help the poor or those with limited income. It was still a fee-for-service market. The legal technician still had to charge and make a living. But it would serve middle-income people, but some on the court said, well, that's not what we really understood. And there were some other things, but one of the more interesting commentaries that shows one of the things we learned from Washington is how uncertain, how contingent things can be, that nothing may be permanent, that bar politics always matter. The state bar never gave up its opposition, and that everything begins and ends with the state Supreme Court. They make the ultimate decision. There were some changes on the court, new members, others left. At least one member changed their mind on a divided court on this issue, and it came to an end. So indeed, maybe it's not an odyssey, but it really is a short story. But I wonder if I can make this go.
Not working.
Can we get a little technical help?
Got it.
Okay.
Not my machine. I blame it on the technology. I won't blame it on the owner, but just on the technology. All right. But was it a harbinger of the future? The commentary that I drew from with the idea of harbinger or one state folly talked about it as a harbinger of what we see more of these. So it was kind of a very specific idea of harbinger, and it's an interesting word. It has negative connotations, positive connotations. The commentary tried to split the middle, pros and cons. Why the word harbinger was used, I'm not sure. But a harbinger can be something bad, harbinger of doom, can be something good, harbinger of spring. And I guess the author of the commentary left it to the reader to figure out whether this was a negative or a positive, a harbinger of doom, or maybe a harbinger of something good. Well, despite what happened in 2020 in Washington State, other states had been looking at this program and looking at the idea, and they started looking at it formally, commissions, task force, put together by state Supreme Courts to explore specifically the Washington program to see if something like it made sense for their state. To date, four states have formally instituted a program that allows what I will call a mid-level legal professional to operate without the supervision of a licensed attorney: Arizona, Colorado, Oregon, and Utah. Interestingly, the two in the middle, I just did them by alphabetical order, Colorado and Oregon just started licensing their mid-level professional last year, post-sunset in Washington. So the problems in Washington didn't stop the idea from moving around. And I think right now Arizona has, what, Don, 70-some?
Low 80s.
Colorado in the first year had 89. Oregon, I can't get a hard count, at least 10. And Utah has, I think, 36 in their program. So despite what happened in Washington, it continues. One state, Minnesota's program, started just this month, interestingly, after a multi-year pilot study to see if it would work. That was new. And the idea is, well, we look back in Minnesota at what those folks elsewhere did, including Washington, they'll be a little more cautious. And they did. Their program is a little different in that it still requires working under the supervision of an attorney. Real quick. No, but
we'll get to it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and so Minnesota is starting a slightly different program with 30 some odd people who were in the pilot project. Now, as many as a dozen other states are exploring some kind of non-lawyer program in specific areas, but doesn't quite line up with the idea of the technician program from Washington State. So it could be a very different, more limited, specially targeted type of thing. But again, Washington State kind of let the genie out of the bottle. All kinds of different ideas of non-lawyers doing something that in the past only a lawyer could do. So in a sense, the takeaway on this part is ongoing. This is just a series of experiments. Everybody's looking at what went right and wrong in Washington. States, as they do it, are looking to see what other states have been doing. what seems to work. So it is an ongoing experiment. It is that kind of trite idea from Brandeis, States' laboratories, but actually it's true here. It's playing out. And it's not, you know, some kind of rational decision-making process, oh, this is a set model we should follow. No. It's more like policymaking in so many other arenas of policymakers trying to do the best they can under the circumstances, constraints, with limited but increasing knowledge. Every time one state looks at that, the knowledge increases. Others go back and look. It's an experiment. And this non-lawyer idea, it's not a short story, is kind of evolving. Not every state is the same. So it's evolving. It's not some nice straight line idea of evolution, like the cartoons you see, that's leading to some ideal end. It's better seen as like a bush. Different branches, different things, and changing. All right. Okay. I want to do a twist on the idea of harbinger. The commentary originally thought of harbinger as more of these programs. Well, we've seen that. But there's another sense in which these programs are harbinger. And it's what I find in looking at what people who are advocating for these programs, in general, what they say of why we need to have these types of mid-level professionals. And they're looking at a future without them. What if we don't do this? We need something. And so they're talking about much more vast ideas on problems with access. Affordability, always been a problem, but the argument is it's going beyond just the poor of limited income. It's the middle class. Most people can't afford an attorney if they need one. An aging profession. Lots of folks are retiring. People of my generation who went in to law as a career are retiring and moving out. It's that kind of bulge from baby boomers like me. But there are sharply lower law school enrollments at the same time. Since about 2010, law school enrollments have tanked to levels that were closer to the early to mid-1970s, and they're not going to go back up. They've plateaued, but it's going to stay low for a while. And along with that, the idea of debt for students that can limit what they can do once they graduate or they want to go to school at all. And then this is something that's maybe more in the West, where most of I've been doing research, but it's the idea of geography, distance, legal deserts. There just aren't lawyers there. This is not a new issue, but it's getting more and more attention. But in short, supply can't and won't be able to meet demand. So here it's the idea of the need for these types of mid-level professionals really is a harbinger of a really bleaker than we have now, access future if we don't do something like this. All right, now I want to talk about something that seems a little different, the analogy. Almost everyone who talks about these programs, advocates them, describes them, are looking for an analogy to explain them. It's uncertain, unsure, what is it? Well, we need something to kind of get across to people what it is, something that will help explain it a bit, will be positive, and the analogy is the nurse practitioner. It's almost always used. And most of us know what it is. We tend to have a positive view of that nurse practitioner, except for my one brother-in-law who hates them and only will see a board-certified physician in some specialty he needs, but he's kind of unusual in that regard. But what if we took that analogy seriously? Perhaps not too literally. A nurse practitioner, by the way, if you don't know, is a graduate degree. You get your basic nursing degree, your bachelor's degree, then it's additional training. But it's training primarily in primary care. There are some specialized areas for nurse practitioners with even more training and certification. But the bulk is this idea of primary care. What if we took it seriously, not just as an analogy, but not just, you know, family law and pro se litigants, but what if we had a broader idea of this kind of mid-level professional? Of the states I mentioned that have initiated programs. Most of them stay pretty narrow. They're the kind of pro se litigant problem in a courthouse. Arizona's a bit different, maybe a lot different. It has a much broader scope of practice than anybody else. There are limitations on it, and they're specified, but it's still a pretty broad area of practice. They can even, and the only one, represent a client in the lowest courts in the state. And some of the things are just not civil, some minor criminal matters as well. That's the closest we have to something like this. But what really made me pay attention to this idea of taking the analogy seriously is something I read many years ago in the report of a 2017 Oregon Futures Task Force for the state bar. And they mused about the legal equivalent of a nurse practitioner who meets all of a person's basic legal needs. That may be the future of the law, a world in which all lawyers are specialists in all routine, they put it in quotes, I'm not sure what that meant, legal work is performed by well-qualified but less expensive non-lawyers. It's an invitation, I think, and there are activists and commentators who are looking seriously at this idea to think creatively, maybe start something new from scratch even in terms of training and what they can do, but thinking creatively about how to and who can deliver legal services. Again, it's the idea, it's a harbinger of possibilities more than anything else, that Washington State program. All right, wrapping it up. Road goes on forever and the party never ends. It's a title of a song by a Texas songwriter named Robert Earl Keane. It was written back in the late 80s, and it's kind of this Americana music, if you know anything about it, that circulates primarily in the West and the Southwest. And it has nothing to do with access to justice. It's a story of two protagonists. The only law in it is that they both steal money. One gets away with the money. The other gets the chair because he shot a lawman. So it's kind of a typical kind of storyline. But what really strikes me about it is that it's a reminder that access to justice is a problem that's never going to go away. That road goes on forever. We never solve it. We can't. But we always try to mitigate it. The party never ends. We keep trying. We look for more ways to mitigate it. The current non-lawyer programs are just one kind of mitigation, even if they do seem a bit radical even in some situations. They're limited, but they do point to broader possibilities. Thinking about that analogy of nurse practitioners seriously in terms of how do we deliver primary care, ongoing care. Would one of these program works? We don't know. We need to experiment. But nobody knew if this mid-level professional idea would work either. And I get drawn back to something in the original order for the Washington State program, in the opinion of then Chief Justice Barbara Madsen. She said, no one has a crystal ball. There's simply no way to know the answer to this question without trying it. And if you again look at how states are trying to do this, that idea is there. Let's try it. Let's see what happens. We got a problem with something? All right, let's try to adjust, try to fix it, but we need to try. So the Washington State program is far from a one-state folly. It really is a harbinger of possibilities, but we need to think creatively about what those possibilities would mean. Thank you.
As we have Michelle come up, let me drop a footnote or two about the Arizona program so you might know. In Arizona, there are family law, legal paraprofessionals, criminal law without incarceration, they can handle that. One of the things that's been popular is bail hearings at 2 a.m. How many lawyers want to do that? But the paraprofessionals will, and if you have a representative at that hearing, your chances of getting bail are much better. There's civil court, our smallest courts, small claims court, juvenile. In representing parents that representation, and we just had our first person pass the administrative law test, so it's broadening. And the charges are about $250 an hour, and the research, I think, shows that most of those people would not have hired a lawyer because they're not going to get one at $250 an hour. So that's sort of where we're at. Michelle.
Thank you. Can everyone hear me okay? So hello, I'm Michelle Statz. I have a PhD in anthropology of law. I'm an associate professor at the University of Minnesota Medical School. I'm affiliated faculty with the University of Minnesota Law School, and I'm an affiliated scholar with the American Bar Foundation. And I am delighted to not be in Minnesota and be here with you today. So thank you for the invitation. And thank you to the American Bar Foundation for also sponsoring a lot of my research. So I want to talk to you today about what this access to justice crisis is like from a more empirically grounded perspective. I want to look in particular about rural access to justice, and I want to talk about a really unique model for addressing it, which is Alaska. So to begin, maybe. There we go. Okay, so I've been doing research on rural access to justice for over a decade. My first federal award for it was from the National Science Foundation, which allowed me to kind of scale it up more broadly in 2017. And over that time, I've prioritized my attention on northern Minnesota and northern Wisconsin, which are actually very diverse rural spaces. And what that's looked like is me conducting one-on-one interviews with over 400 private and public interest attorneys, tribal and state court judges, and local stakeholders. So I'm in my car a lot. That's a lot of distance to cover. My team has additionally conducted over 250 individual and household surveys with low-income rural community members who have civil legal needs, which is ostensibly everyone, right? And I currently collaborate with 18 tribal and state courts across this region and in Iowa on more sort of specific research on active judging in rural jurisdictions. And that research has involved interviews with partnering judges, over 200 litigant surveys, and countless hours of courtroom observation. So I have a fairly good and lived sense of the kinds of consequences of rural justice gaps. And I should say that I myself am from a small town, grew up on a farm, so I can frankly bullshit quite well with rural people, so which is not part of my formal training. But I want to give you a broader scope and scale of rural justice gaps in the United States. We know that over 10 million rural Americans have incomes below 125% of the federal poverty line. Three quarters of low-income rural residents experience at least one civil legal problem each year, but on average, it's more than six. Still, only 14% of rural individuals receive assistance for their civil legal needs. This is a rate less than half the national average. Just out of curiosity, is anyone in this room from a rural community? Okay. So that not many, but you're representing. Now, a lot of people want to explain rural justice gaps as a matter of legal deserts or growing rural attorney shortages, right? We just heard about these. And this makes sense. Presently, only about 2% of all solo practitioners and small firm law practices are located in small towns. There are even fewer free legal aid attorneys. And those legal aid offices that exist, I'm sure Rudy knows this really well, cover vast geographies of land. There are no rural law schools with relevant clinical support, and few, if any, large firms that can offer pro bono support. So that's real, but I have to admit that I get a little bit frustrated with this focus on attorney shortages because it tends to neglect the broader context. So in other words, there are other and more complicated barriers to accessing justice in rural communities. In addition to rural legal deserts, these spaces also contend with profound shortages in health and mental health care providers, educational opportunities, treatment centers, affordable housing, and other critical support. This makes it really hard to point someone in the right direction if their legal need has to do with chemical dependency, housing, or accessing medical benefits. It also significantly makes it very hard to recruit and retain new JDs to these areas. There's also physical distance, right? Long distances, absent public transportation. Many people lack personal transportation that's consistent. There are digital barriers. We heard a lot about broadband deserts during the pandemic, but there's also very limited cellular service in many rural spaces. One of the communities where I do research only reached 80% coverage, cellular coverage, in 2019. And before that, it was 20% cell service. There are also some economic and policy barriers that I don't have time to get into today, but suffice it to say, many state courts are wildly underfunded and overlooked, and many tribal courts are funded through gaming dollars, which of course took a hit during the pandemic and haven't necessarily recovered. The final barrier makes me wildly unpopular among a lot of my Access to Justice colleagues. But my data also demonstrate that many of the prevailing self-help innovations are themselves barriers. Most of these supports are hopelessly urban normative, which is a very clunky way of saying that they're designed by individuals in urban spaces with urban populations in mind. So this could be an app, a courthouse kiosk, a hotline, an online fillable court form. Like, great ideas, right? We want these things to work. And yet most of these innovations presume that an individual will have a smartphone or a tablet or consistent access to the internet or working hours that coincide with when the courthouse is open, and many rural folks just do not. So this is a really devastating reality, and it leads to the heart of my research, which has a lot to do with feelings. And boy, do legal professionals love to talk about feelings. So overwhelmingly, the rural litigants that I've interviewed consistently and overwhelmingly talk about feeling ashamed that they can't figure out court forms, frustrated that they can't access a legal help website, and embarrassed that they can't make sense of Westlaw at the courthouse law library. I will say I am a tenured professor with many advanced degrees, and I can't make sense of Westlaw at the law library. One person likened this process of self-representation to going to the doctor and being asked not only to diagnose himself, but to figure out his own course of treatment. Another person said, one mistake on those forms will cause someone at the courthouse window to tell you to start all over again. And then you think, what happens if I screw this up? Will I lose my kids? So I don't think it's very surprising that most rural individuals don't feel comfortable or confident when looking for a legal remedy for their problems. And it's similarly unsurprising that those very well-intentioned but urban normative self-help supports don't or simply can't take into consideration the realities of rural marginalization, poverty, and shame when it comes to trying to access justice. So this is where I used to end my talks, and it was incredibly depressing. But my research has continued, which is a nice thing. And I've really paid deep, deep attention to this particular thing. How does it feel? How does it feel to try to access justice in this particular context, often when you're in crisis? So overwhelmingly, my data demonstrate that individuals prioritize legal advocacy that is dignifying, that is spatially and culturally representative, that is expert and accessible. And in 2021, I was delighted to learn that this actually exists. So for those of you who don't know, I also do work on the community justice worker model, which comes out of Alaska. And this is something that I learned about through my work with the American Bar Foundation. And in about 2022, 2021, I received an offer that I couldn't refuse. I really kind of felt a little bullied into it, but that's another story. Would I collaborate on a grant that that would study and advance this nascent community justice worker model. And I want to say here, just very quickly, these are photos taken from my research. This is a state courthouse in northwestern Wisconsin. That's a tribal court bench on the lower bottom in Iowa. And this is actually a courthouse in rural Alaska. It has no courtroom. It's actually just a double wide trailer, but it works, right? And so I think we need to remember what works might look different from the prevailing models that we're used to. So for those of you who aren't aware of it, the community justice worker model was inspired by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium's CHAPS program, or their community health aid and practitioner model. So like Stephen was already saying, we can often find very helpful analogies in the medical context. Community health aides work in 170 rural Alaska villages and provide emergent, acute, and chronic care to residents of their communities. So critically, these are individuals who are already locally known and trusted and who deeply understand the lay of the land. In other words, their care is very dignifying. They understand what those individuals in their communities in crisis need. CHAPS are extensively trained, follow well-established practice standards and policies, and work within a hub and spoke referral pattern. So in other words, if symptom acuity remains high, I know this language from working at a med school, patients are transferred to a higher level of care outside of the community. And then those health aides are in constant dialogue with this broader healthcare team. The model has been in existence for over 55 years, and it has been so successful that there are now also dental health therapists and behavioral health aides all across Alaska. A number of years ago, the executive director of Alaska Legal Services asked, "Why can't we do something like this? We're turning away over 50% of the people who are coming to our doors, and we will never, ever have enough attorneys, let alone culturally representative attorneys, who can serve these communities." So the more I learned about this model, the more enthusiastic I felt. I didn't really feel that bullied. The model provides in-person, culturally and linguistically representative, highly trained and supervised advocacy. It's like it ticked every single box on that data-driven wish list I had in my head for rural access to justice. So, together with colleagues from ALSC, from the American Bar Foundation, and from ASU, we applied for an NSF Civic Innovation Grant. And because the model proved so successful, we were able to secure a second round of funding for $1 million to evaluate and scale up the model in and beyond Alaska. And I want to show you a video right now. Adam, I might need your help. Just to give you a little bit more of an idea about what that looks like.
The United States.
Adam? Oh, okay, thank you. Should I play it? Okay. It's like, don't touch it.
Some of those MLKs look a little young.
And like they're having way too much fun.
Faces a civil access to justice crisis. The most recent national data show us that 92% of low-income Americans cannot access the services they need to address their civil legal needs.
But what's happening in the civil justice system is kind of under the radar. It's a very quiet crisis, even though it's enormous. So if you look at the best information we have about Americans and their civil justice experiences, they have probably 150 million to 250 million new civil justice problems every year. And that's things like being threatened with eviction from your home, not being able to access health care for your kids, not being paid overtime that you're owed by your employer, all kinds of things that can have really significant impacts on people's lives. And as far as we know, most of those justice issues, particularly for poor people, get no assistance of any kind. And the reason for that is not because we don't want to help people who have these really significant issues, but because the systems that we have in place to provide help to those folks are just not big enough for such a gigantic problem.
Alaska is no exception to this crisis. In fact, the very rurality of its populations, and in particular such rural and remote Alaska Native communities, only intensifies the challenges that people face in trying to address such life-altering civil legal issues.
The area that my organization, Alaska Legal Services, covers is the entire state, and Alaska is bigger than the next three states combined. That's California, Montana, and Texas. And so to cover that entire area and to provide free civil legal aid, my organization is really the only resource for people who can't afford an attorney.
Current models of civil legal services delivery for low-income and vulnerable Americans, and particularly for those living in rural and remote areas, have failed to respond to this crisis. Yet effective, scalable, and sustainable community-based models for rural services delivery exist in other areas. This includes the transformative impact of embedded, culturally responsive community health workers who provide frontline medical, dental, and behavioral health services.
The access to justice problem is incredible in Alaska. It's similar to the access to healthcare. There's not community-based legal advocates or workers in those communities or lawyers that are within those communities or members of the communities. The Community Justice Worker Program leverages on programs that have developed over the last 50 years to provide that level of services in the communities based on community members, providing the education that's needed to do that, and in a team-based fashion with Alaska Legal Services attorneys supervising and supporting these community justice workers.
During stage one of the Civic Innovation Challenge, our civic partners have made significant strides in realizing the opportunity to scale community justice workers in Alaska and beyond. Perhaps most significantly, we obtained a waiver from the Alaska Supreme Court that will allow non-lawyers to provide legal advice and representation, eliminating a key regulatory barrier. Leveraging this waiver, ALSC built and tested a new domestic violence training module and in-person curriculum with an inaugural cohort of community health aides. During this time, our team also met with 18 institutional stakeholders and conducted 28 individual and group interviews with community members in Alaska. This allowed us to solidify key partnerships and build community awareness and interest in the program. Finally, we designed potential models for sustainability, including earned income for community justice workers, cross-subsidization within organizations, and Medicaid reimbursement for health-harming legal needs. Our stage one findings suggest that the community justice worker model is poised for scale and sustainability both within and beyond Alaska. A design workshop that we facilitated with over 50 potential legal aid partners from across the U.S. allowed us to more deeply explore challenges and develop innovative solutions for scaling the community justice worker model. Joe Nelson, co-chair of the Alaska Federation of Natives and the Alaska Legal Services Board Chair, shares this powerful message.
The Community Justice Worker Program, though, gives us hope that our communities and people that need access will get that access from peers and others that know the place as well as they should. So I hope you too will support the Community Justice Worker Program in Alaska. Sheesh.
Thank you, Adam.
Cambiar vidas.
I mean, we could keep watching TV if you want. So I'm just about to wrap up, but I do want to say that it's very important to me to always communicate to audiences that these are data-driven insights, right? I'm not up here just sharing my opinion. And as a researcher, we really wanted to have clear, empirical, robust proof of concept for the community justice worker model. Yeah, that's this one right
here.
This
is okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
No, that's great. Okay, perfect. So for the past 2 years, There we go. We're good. So for the past 2 years, we've been rigorously documenting the experiences of community justice workers, their clients, and community members through observations and one-on-one interviews. And this past September, our team traveled to Alaska for ongoing field work. And as part of that, a few of us attended a WILS clinic in a Native Alaska village on the Bering Sea. So I will say, to get there, we had to take a single-engine prop plane. I got to sit right in front. I never need to do that again. But what made it completely worthwhile was the opportunity to witness very remote people in the United States working through their legal questions with a trusted expert, all in the Yupik language. It was an amazing thing to behold. So taken together, the data we've collected are resoundingly positive and very informative, and they're being used to refine the existing work of CJWs and scale it up even across the U.S. Presently, CJWs serve 41 communities across Alaska, and in 2024, they closed 227 cases. So as you heard from this, we now have a waiver which allows CJWs to represent clients in tribal and state courts. We presently have training modules for SNAP, WILS, Indian Child Welfare, debt and domestic violence prevention orders, and courses are being developed right now for ethics or professional responsibility, disaster response, eviction defense, and probate. As I think Rudy will talk about in a second, the program has expanded to 4 other Indigenous-serving legal aid organizations, including Anishinaabe Legal in Minnesota, DNA, Montana Legal, and Oklahoma Indian Legal. And as I'm sure everyone here is aware, the movement has incredible momentum elsewhere. This includes justice worker enabling reforms, both proposed or realized, in states like Arizona, Delaware, New York, Hawaii, and Texas. So I'm happy to talk about this more in the Q&A. But I will just for now end by saying that I think a number of my articles were circulated, and I'm always happy to talk if anyone else has questions. So thank you.
Rudy, you're up.
Are we putting your computer up here?
Well, my slides are on there, and I'm just going to read from this.
Okay. All right. So there
it is. And just to go ahead, just.
Spacebar or the back four key, whichever one you want. Enter my work to go.
Okay. So good afternoon. My name is Rudy Sanchez, and I'm the executive director of DNA People's Legal Services. DNA People's Legal Services is a nonprofit law firm that was founded in 1967. DNA is not DNA testing. People come to the office sometimes and they want to do blood work, and I tell them, sorry, that's not us. It's an acronym for a Navajo phrase, Dene, Dene Be Ina Nathina Be Aki, which translated means lawyers who work for the economic revitalization of the people. We have 6 offices. 3 on the Navajo Nation. The main office is in Window Rock, Arizona, Chinle, Arizona, and Tuba City. We have 1 office on the Hopi Nation near Keams Canyon on the Justice Bureau of Indian Affairs Judicial Compound, and then 1 in Flagstaff, Arizona, which also has an intake unit, and 1 in Farmington, New Mexico. And so from that, you can see our area is very rural. It covers, it's parts of 3 states. It is super large. The Navajo Nation by itself is 26,500 square miles. Coconino County, Arizona is the 2nd largest county in the United States. And then it also has a number of Indian tribes that are in our service area. So we have Navajo, Hopi, Hickory, Apache, Hualapai, Havasupai, San Juan Paiute, and Kibab Paiute. And so it is very culturally diverse. It's very rural. The largest city in our service area is Flagstaff, Arizona, which is a city of 75,000. The next largest city is Farmington, New Mexico, which is a city of 50,000. The rest of the communities are tiny. I have this slide kind of describes some of our client population. So the funding that we receive is to provide services to low-income people, but the majority of our funding is to provide services to Native Americans. And this slide is not about legal problems. This is a story I saw in the New York Times in 2022 during the COVID pandemic, and it talks about the drop in life expectancy for Native Americans and Native Alaskans. And it's just a highlight. And the main points I got out of this is in 2020, there was a drop in life expectancy for Native Americans of 4 years. And a total of 6 years from 2020 to 2022. And the average life expectancy of Native Americans was 65, which looking around this room and myself, we would be close to that. That's on par with all of Americans, the life expectancy for all of Americans in 1944. And the average life expectancy was lower than every country in the Americas except for Haiti. And so this article isn't about legal problems, but what feeds into the drop in life expectancy and what flows out of the drop in life expectancy are horrendous legal problems. Some main causes for the drop in life expectancy are substance abuse, lack of infrastructure and general hopelessness, which are connected to domestic violence, unemployment, horrible housing conditions or no housing, lack of health care, debt collections, probate work, guardianships, and the list goes on and on. And so the other panelists, they were talking about the use of non-lawyers, and it's based on research. And what I saw my role when I was asked to join this panel was really to talk about a firsthand view of some of the challenges that there are in delivering legal services, as well as an idea on how to address those challenges, and in particular allowing and training non-lawyers to help. And so my comments are based on my personal experience, what I've seen and heard over the last 30 years working in rural parts of the country, the last 6 years with DNA People's Legal Services. And as part of that work, I've had the opportunity to work with DNA staff, the New Mexico Access to Justice Commission, the Arizona Access to Justice Commission, the Legal Services Corporation Rural Justice Task Force, and participation at the Utah Access to Justice Summit. And based on that experience, I agree with what Stephen and Michelle said, that one fundamental problem to providing legal services is that there aren't enough lawyers to provide services to everyone who needs help. There are, however, other challenges, especially in rural areas, such as lack of phone and internet services, isolated communities, cultural and language issues, transportation issues caused by long distances and poor and old roads, and other foundational problems. What I've learned is that there is no silver bullet that will provide everybody an opportunity to obtain legal help. And DNA has experimented in various ways to increase access to services. So we've set up an online telephone intake unit. We've supported outreach efforts of our staff by buying cars, hotspots, satellite systems, a travel trailer, RV, cell phones, hotspots. But in keeping with the topic of this panel, I'm going to focus my last few minutes on the issue of redefining who can deliver legal services, if not licensed attorneys. And in that respect, we have to be willing to experiment. And one way to do that is to train community members or staff and volunteers without formal credentials to provide legal services. And this concept is being supported in a range of different ways in Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, with a host of novel ideas such as community justice workers, legal document preparers, paraprofessional legal workers, use of internet portals with guidance from trusted advisors, tribal lay advocates, and the Utah Sandbox. But it's a deeper discussion than this, just to say who can provide legal services, because you have to get into the weeds of what is the unauthorized practice of law. Specifically, what type of help can non-attorneys currently provide? What's regulated, what's not regulated? What's authorized and what's not authorized? What's prohibited and what's allowed? For example, the Alaska model, it changed the difference of the practice of law. And as I understand it, it allows a person to do anything a lawyer can do except appear in court or file pleadings, as long as a person doesn't hold himself out as a lawyer, as long as they're working under the supervision of Alaska Legal Services attorneys, and as long as they don't charge any money. But even that approach leaves a lot on the table. For instance, many administrative agencies have their own, and administrative courts have their own rules of admission. Immigration court, Social Security Administration, tax court, unemployment compensation commissions, workers' compensation commissions, and tribal courts. In any event, allowing non-lawyers to provide legal services, it's really not a new concept. We've talked about the novel idea of it. But for years, DNA has relied on non-law school trained staff to provide legal services, in particular tribal court attorneys. And then more recently, we've become part of the community justice worker movement. So as Michelle had spoken, we received a grant from the Legal Services through Alaska, from the Legal Services Corporation to set up community justice workers who could provide some level of legal help in areas that were declared disasters. We have two community justice workers. Unlike the Alaska model, they're paid. One is based, she's a member of the Havasupai tribe. And if any of you know geography, Havasupai tribe is located at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. So lawyers don't go there, because you have to get there by helicopter or mule or walking. And it's a pretty exhaustive trip to get there. And once you get there, there's no internet, very little internet. The other community justice worker is based in New Mexico. He covers an area of 7 counties. But the reason DNA got involved in that was because for many years we had a tribal court advocate trainee program. One thing that's unique about DNA is that we practice in Navajo tribal court. The two ways to get admitted there are, if you're a licensed attorney, you take a bar exam. If you are Native American and a graduate of college and a certified paralegal program, you take the same bar exam. So obviously, there are very few tribal court advocates because the bar exam is pretty hard. And we used to have a very successful advocate trainee program, and I wanted to use the community justice worker model to kickstart that program. So that was what we decided to do. We decided to participate in that program. A few years ago, there were 650 members of the Navajo Bar, with about 60 of them who were not state licensed, and more than, I want to say, two-thirds of them had come through DNA to get their tribal court advocate license. And they're very successful. We had some staff who went on to become justice of the Navajo Supreme Court. Anyways, I'm going to stop, and I think we're going to take questions. And so thank you for the opportunity to talk about the work that I do.
You know, as we get started to take questions, I wonder if there are people in the audience who might want to share something about what your state or community is doing in the same vein of these non-lawyer legal service providers, because we only know what we know. Yes, sir. Okay, you got the mic there.
My name is John Skilton. I'm from Wisconsin. I chaired the ABA Delivery Committee for 3 years. It was on the heels of the Gingrich defunding efforts of the Legal Services Corporation. which inspired the ABA to get going. Bill Eide had his program at the time. Wisconsin borrowed from it when I was its bar president. What I want to focus on in my brief comments is the notion of, in addition to creative alternatives to direct delivery, and we dealt with hotlines and other alternative issues, including lawyer participation. When you get into the bar politics, it's regressive in terms of your ability to sell alternative delivery systems. And I don't know what's happened to these hotlines that were so hot in 94. So accordingly, I want to talk about an approach that we had took simultaneously. We created the Equal Justice Coalition, Equal Justice Fund. The purpose of that was to raise funds to support existing legal service delivery firms in the state of Wisconsin. It was created in roughly 1999, roughly, and we've raised about $8 million through that process. Now, that's a spit in the bucket, but having said that, the bucket needs to have more in it. And the next thing we did was with me testifying in Wisconsin Supreme Court on a mandatory assessment of lawyers, the 20,000 some lawyers, of $50 per lawyer. Needless to say, it was not an easy argument. I have argued mandatory bar issues for 10 years, including three arguments in the Seventh Circuit, so I'm schooled on the constitutional questions, but we prevailed. And so as a result of the combination of private fundraising and mandatory assessments, we have been able to provide meaningful, not determinative, but meaningful support to our legal service agencies, existing ones, not trying to recreate scenario, but rather to support them and ask them to expand in areas that they have been trained to deliver. And it is not a complete project. We are falling short, but nevertheless, it's helpful.
Thank you for sharing. Anyone else want to talk about what's going on in your community? Well, let me drop another footnote to the conversation, because you're in Arizona. In Arizona, there are over 100 alternative business structure law firms, which means that there's an ownership in total or in part of non-lawyers. Among those services that are being provided, you can get a trademark for $650. For $250, you can get your marijuana conviction expunged. For $600, you can get a green card. It is because the technology stack has been invested by monies that were not available from just the lawyers themselves, but these companies have developed a technology stack that allows for questions to be answered in depth before the client ever sees the lawyer, and the lawyer really basically has a complete interview, you know, before he or she gets started. So we can answer questions about that too. But I'm wondering, Steve, what's next in your study, and where are you going to go from here? In terms of trying to document this.
Is this on? Yes. Well, this is a study that's been going on for a number of years, kind of slowed down because of the pandemic like anything else. And I have a collaborator I've been working on this stuff for 8 or 9 years. And we've just been watching things go. And the biggest challenge right now is it just keeps going. You know, we're trying to work like on a book manuscript. Well, that's nice. We like that at the foundation. And so you have a beginning, a middle, but hold it, it's still the middle. And so the biggest challenge is figuring out how to kind of draw some kind of conclusion to put all of the research together. And so it's been keeping track of what's going. You know, Minnesota, as I said, is just starting. Texas is going to be trying something. And I think we're going to wind up doing really is just focusing on the initial set of states that really set the stage for what's going to happen in the future in terms of digging in the weeds, which I couldn't do today. But what happened? How did these different committees and task force really try to deal with this? I mean, having, you know, attended meetings, reading minutes and all, this is serious business, serious pragmatic people trying to figure out what will work. And there's a lot to learn from that in terms of the recalcitrance of the organized bar, whether it's Wisconsin or any place else, and in a sense trying to pull together from all of that material, in a sense, what are the lessons? If your state or your interest is in something like this, or as I said at the end, thinking creatively about something completely different, as Michelle and her collaborators are, what do you need to worry about? What are the pitfalls? What worked? How did this process play out? There's much to learn from looking at the process itself, because it's going to keep going. And hopefully it is the idea of learning from what's been done before, so you're not doing it from scratch every time.
Okay, Jimmy Goodman.
Yeah, Jimmy Goodman from Oklahoma. It seems that over the years when we've looked at these issues, there's sort of three major impediments, and there are others, but I think the three major ones are, what about the ethics, confidentiality, the things that, you know, we hold sacred in terms of that? What about the competency? And then what about this issue that putting all this money into this effort is going to take business away from the young rural lawyers, and we shouldn't be doing that. You know, we ought to be working for our profession. And the one thing that we don't have, at least I'm not aware of, and maybe it exists, and if so, to the panel, this is the question, what sort of specific evidence have we collected about the ethics is no worse with the non-lawyers than it is with lawyers. The competency is no bigger a problem with the non-lawyers than it is with the lawyers. In fact, maybe it's even better, because sometimes they're limited in what they can do, and lawyers try to do everything, and they're not always competent in doing everything. And then the third, what evidence have we collected, or if we haven't collected it, what evidence can we collect about this issue of taking business away from the young lawyers in rural America? Those seem to be the three biggest ones that I hear all the time. And until we have a message that we can deliver with some proof to back it up, we're not going to get through that.
Anybody on the panel want to field that? Michelle?
Okay, so we actually do have a lot of data on all of these things. And we are lucky in that our neighbors in the UK have been using, for lack of a better term, non-lawyer advocates in certain domains of practice for quite a while now. And the research on these advocates demonstrates exactly what you said, which is that in terms of success of cases, they're basically analogous to people with their JDs, right? There are some ethical issues, no more, no less than people who are trained as attorneys. Competence, like you said again, in that these people specialize in a particular case type and form of advocacy, they are generally more expert and successful in their advocacy than someone who is a generalist. And then where I come in, we have enormous data on the extent of rural legal deserts, as well as the incredibly concerted and longstanding efforts by different rural people and rural serving law schools, among them South Dakota's Project Rural Practice. Nebraska has incentivized training programs for rural practicing JDs. Wisconsin, for a while, had the justice bus, and they're not working. They're overwhelmingly not working, to the point that when you have these rural jurisdictions that are not only desperate for private practitioners and public defenders, but also for county attorneys, for judges, there's no one. And I see this viscerally in my research in the Midwest and around the U.S. So there's really good research on this coming out of South Carolina. Elizabeth Chambliss is someone
We have others in Texas. I'd be very happy to provide you with those resources. But I am not, I'm very sad to say that I am not worried about local rural bars being threatened. I'm very worried about those local rural bars becoming non-existent.
Rudy, do you have anything to add to that?
I would add that it really gets into the issue of what services are the non-lawyers going to provide. I mean, they're not going to take an appeal to the Supreme Court. They don't have the training for that. But there is a lower level of services that they can provide. Some people already do some things that maybe border, maybe are on the line. You know, helping somebody apply for some sort of public benefit and giving them guidance on how to present their case. You know, some people, you get into discussions with lawyers, I've had people say, oh, I was sitting in a barber chair and someone started asking me a question. I was in law school and I started answering and someone said, oh, you're a licensed practice of law. You know, so really you have to get into the issue of what services are they going to provide, what services are available, and you can't just at the front end say, well, that's just wrong. That's just, you know, I went to law school, I learned how to do all this stuff, because there are a lot of things that we do that non-lawyers could do. And there are a lot of things that we do that really aren't unlicensed practice of law. And so it's good to have the discussion, and it's good to address those three points. But the people who are being served, I guess, by community justice workers or these non-attorneys are people who won't have access to any other services. And that's really the issue. It is, do they get zero services or do they get some services? There's going to be a study released sometime either this spring or maybe this summer. The Legal Services Corporation did I was on the Rural Justice Task Force, and they have a study on rural legal services that's going to talk about, highlight some of the problems. And, you know, the big problem is there are no lawyers in a lot of these rural areas. And if there are lawyers, if you look at the map and it says, oh, this county has five lawyers, they all work for the county. Right, so they're not people who are providing services to anybody who needs legal help, and so that really is the debate. But it's an ongoing debate. I remember when I was a young lawyer, my program set up a pro se divorce clinic, and the idea was to bring people in as a group. They had uncontested divorces. They didn't have family. They didn't have property, and they wanted a divorce because they wanted to get on with their lives. They wanted to, you know, marry somebody else, but they didn't have any money. So we put on a class. We explained what the process was. We drafted pleadings that they signed. We walked into the courthouse and they filed them. And after, you know, 60 days, they would have a hearing as a group. And there were some lawyers who said, "Hey, that person could have paid me $50." Right, so I understand what the issue is, but it really it gets to that level, and you just have to think no services or some services, and then you do have to figure out how you monitor to make sure that what's provided is actually, you know, not malpractice.
Okay, one in the back there.
Yeah, so I have Sherry Levin Wallach from New York. And I'm a past president of the New York State Bar, but I'm more relevant to my comments here. I'm the deputy executive director of Legal Aid Society of Westchester County. And so I have to take exception to anywhere that we are spending grant money or funding on non-lawyers when our legal services organizations are having their money swept across the country. And in particular, we just saw this in New York. So we can sit here and say that it makes a lot of sense for us to pay non-lawyers, but we're taking that money from those individuals who actually are trained to provide the proper representation to the clients. And we can serve more people if we have the funding. The problem is that the legal services organizations often don't have the funding. And by the way, we lose attorneys regularly because of the cost of doing, you know, the opportunity to make more money somewhere else because we can't pay them or because we don't have enough money to pay enough lawyers for the caseloads. And so we're sitting here suggesting that we should take that money and give it to non-lawyers. And I will argue that that will also solve some of this rural justice gap issues because we don't even have the ability to provide the funding to those legal services organizations in these rural communities. In upstate New York, for example, we have a very hard time holding legal services attorneys because of the money issues, because we can't fund the money. So that's one point. I think it's a very significant one. And so when I hear that we can pay someone $250 who's a non-lawyer to do what a lawyer could do, I can tell you that assigned counsel attorneys in New York State just got a raise from $90 an hour to $158 an hour to do legal work. So paying someone else $250 anywhere to me is a mistake, and it's taking out away from the lawyers. And we make the analogy to the medical world. I grew up in a medical family. I remember what happened when we changed our medical system. And quite frankly, I don't think there's anybody in this room who hasn't had to argue with their insurance company to get the test they need or the treatment they need, or they're told, sorry, you're out of network, or some ridiculous algorithm that gives you maybe $70 on 7,000 to pay. And that's where we're going to end up with legal services if we're not careful. And in the medical right now, where we are with medicine in this country, it's unfortunate, quite frankly. We are not providing the proper medical care to our people, and we are not giving them the testing that they need. And people are not able to access it because of this change. So I think that that's a flawed analogy. And I want to go to the education point, because I think that if we can educate non-lawyers to do legal work, then why are we not educating them to become lawyers? Why are we not providing education in the rural communities for those individuals who want to do the legal work as lawyers and allowing them to do the work? We have that opportunity to do it, but we're not doing it. We're educating non-lawyers, and we're saying, but you don't need to take a bar exam, or you don't need to have a license. And then you run into the ethical dilemma, which I could go on and on, but this will be my last point, which is this. And the gentleman over there and a couple people mentioned this, right? You have the same, quote unquote, ethical issues. Yes, maybe. But the problem is that there's no recourse against a non-lawyer. Not the same recourse. You don't lose your license or your ability to practice. And what's happening where we're going after lawyers and there's constant issues of ineffective assistance of counsel. I do criminal defense predominantly right now, but I've done civil litigation. It's a problem because nobody is held to that standard if they're not a lawyer. And we have judges who are non-lawyers around our country and in New York State who are also running into those same problems, but at least they're covered by the Judicial Commission, right? So we have to be very careful, I think, and I appreciate the work, but I argue to say, why are we not suggesting, to the point that was made by the gentleman on the end about clinics, right? We can have lawyer oversight. We can provide clinical work if we want to. Let's make more clinics then. That's great. Let's teach people to do the work and have lawyers oversee them so there's a level of responsibility. Ultimately, otherwise, we're just paying it into the economy and no one's being held accountable. And I think that's a serious, serious problem for our people, the people we represent and the citizens of our country.
Well, I'll just drop a footnote for Arizona. If you're a legal paraprofessional and you violated an ethical rule, you'd be disbarred. You'd lose your license. It would be the same. But I think it's different for community justice workers and for people who aren't certified in some way. And so the views differ. Sir, you have a comment or a question?
Sure. So I'm John Thies from Illinois and have served for many years on the board of the largest legal aid organization in the state of Illinois. So I care a lot about this. And I think everything that's been said about access to justice, I think, is true. And you're really preaching the converted. The room full of lawyers knows this better than anybody. And I love the data. I appreciate that you're getting great data. And I could talk about a lot of different things, but I just want to focus on one. One of the professors used the word recalcitrance.
in referring to the bar. And I take issue with that, because the bar is the one that spends millions of hours of pro bono work and donates millions of dollars to legal aid organizations and has done more to try to address the access to justice crisis than any non-lawyer group, and certainly not KMPG. And what concerns me is that, you know, you're preaching the converted. We all care a lot about access to justice. I would argue more than the non-lawyers. But the issue is being co-opted by groups like KMPG, or KPMG?
KPMG.
That's what it is. Don, you probably represented them. It's being co-opted by groups like that who don't care about access to justice. And what I fear is that we're going to do things that are going to radically change our ethical rules, 5.4 in particular. We're going to radically change those rules, maybe well-meaning, to try to do a better job on access to justice. But the result is it's going to open the door to groups that they just don't care about access to justice. And it's going to set back those of us who do.
For those that are not following this, one of the applications most recently for an Arizona alternative business structure license was multi-global, planetary, KPMG. Interestingly enough, the Supreme Court did not act on their application. It was approved by the Oversight Committee, and then all of the other approvals went through about a day ago, and all of us were looking to see what happened to KPMG, and we don't really know. I've had it happen once before. I presume the court had particular questions that they wanted answered by KPMG before they would talk about it. But I've asked some of the lawyers involved. They don't know either. So we're sort of sitting, waiting here with bated breath. Anybody on the panel want to react to what has been said? Go ahead.
Well, no. One, I was going to mention that. So in Arizona, they also just recently adopted an administrative order, and I put it should be in your materials, to authorize community justice workers through the legal services, legal service programs. And so we're not getting more money, right? It's just loosening who can provide some level of legal services. And it really is a much deeper discussion. It does get down to money. How much money do you have to provide legal services? And all legal services programs are underfunded. And I know because I'm the executive director of a legal services program. And I know we always face funding crises like we did earlier this week. But this is not saying, instead of giving the money to legal services programs for lawyers, let's give it for community justice workers. This is just experiments in different states to authorize people to do certain kinds of work. And there is a big discussion. Is it authorized or is it allowed or is it just redefining what the unlicensed practice of law is? And so community justice worker or non-lawyer professional, it means different things to different people. And you don't get the same answer. And if you go to one bar group or one Access to Justice Commission, they give you a different idea of what they think it should be. So I'm just pushing the concept that there aren't enough lawyers. And you have to, for people to have access to services, you have to figure out how you tweak the rules. But I'm not saying defund this or defund that or anything like that or shift money any which way.
Yeah, and I want to jump on here as well. And something I should have stated during my presentation is that when I talk about community justice workers serving 41 communities across Alaska, the majority of those individuals are already embedded in different social service organizations. So they are being paid by the organizations themselves. So they're working at realty divisions, they're working at tribal corporations, they're working for domestic violence shelters. Those are agencies that are paying CJWs directly. So it's a little bit of a misnomer to call them volunteer advocates, right? Because this is just simply now part of their work. I also want to state for the record that Alaska doesn't have a law school, right? Minnesota and Wisconsin, where I do research, have 5 law schools between them. Not a one provides any sort of specialized training in rural law practice.
most rural communities do not ever get recruiters from colleges and universities. It is not easy for rural community members to go to law school, but if they did, they would be some of the best advocates out there.
Steve, you want to?
Just a couple of things, and some of it even goes back to what Jimmy Goodman was saying. On the ethics for the programs I talked about, as Don mentioned, there are ethics requirements, just as there are for licensed attorneys in those states. And if you screw up, you lose your license. And in Washington State, a few have. But it's been a while since I've done research on lawyer discipline, but I was always surprised most of what I did was in Texas. And a lot of it were younger lawyers who were basically not competent. And they were just getting into trouble by not knowing how to practice law. And you see that in a lot of bar reports criticizing legal education and how people are trained. They're not trained to do stuff and all. But the organized programs that I talked about, they have very real ethics requirements to get licensed. You have in terms of taking money away from legal aid, the programs I talked about are fee-for-service private market things, just like attorneys. So they're not taking money away from legal aid at all. As to Jimmy's earlier point about the young lawyer, I think it's an empty niche. Where in God's name, Jimmy, are those young lawyers going to those communities? The more I look, the more I find they're just not there. And there are a lot of reasons why they're not going to those communities. And often you had a family problem
too. Some folks are born made to wave the flag. Ooh, they're red, white, and blue. And when the band plays Hail to the Chief,
precisely the reasons that Michelle talked about. And that's a whole different thing than we've been talking about in terms of getting more attorneys there, in terms of looking at what do we do to help people who want to go to law school to serve communities that they come from. But
yes. Is it okay? I tell you what, because we have reached the end of the session, I think I'm going to call it. But I'm sure people will remain here. I see some expectant faces up here. They'd love to talk. Phil, do you want to have the last word?
Thanks for organizing this.
Since you've been
access.
I can take the afternoon, the nighttime comes around too soon. You can know what you mean to me. Your poison letter, your telegram. Just goes to show you don't give a damn. Since you've been gone, since you've been gone, out of my head can't take it.
Stable foundation for more research and more reform. So, what am I missing? Why don't we all together, first and foremost, try to lay the foundation in the form of a civil case?
Good place to end. Pregnant question. All right, I'm going to call it as it's over. But the panel is here. We'd love to talk with you. Thank you for your forbearance. Let's give them a round of applause.
I'm sorry, everyone. One final note. Is it not on?
Up here.